Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here, and today on Garden Talk, we'll start with some information for the new gardener, and of course, we're here to answer any other gardening questions you might have. Our guest, Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. So, what gardening questions are on your mind? Love to hear from you. You can join in at 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And again, love to hear from you. So get in touch. Lisa Johnson, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks, Larry, for asking me.
You know, I bet my bet would be wrong, but I'm betting that more people have been contacting you this spring about gardening.
There are certainly a lot of new gardeners this year. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what kinds of questions are you getting?
Well, at this point in the season, we usually get a lot more questions about things that are already existing in the yard rather than things that people are actually planting. So I tend to get a lot of weed questions at this time of year, what is this weed, weed du jour sorts of things. Also lots of questions about lawns at this time of year, curling crabgrass and that sort of thing. I get my share of tree questions at this time of year as well. And with the recent freeze, of course, there have been a number of sad-looking plants after that event.
Yeah, for sure. Do you ever talk with them about soil testing? And do you think it's important to get soil tested?
Yes, actually, early in the season, the majority of the questions that come in are about soil testing and how and where to get it. I do believe that it is an important thing, especially if you're starting a new garden or you've bought a new house and you really don't know where you're at in terms of what your pH is, which is a measure of alkalinity and acidity of the soil. What kind of texture you have, whether you've got more clay, whether you've got more silt, that kind of thing. So it is important. At this time, I am not real sure about the UW Soils Lab. I've been hearing that they are taking limited samples. However, their website says that they are still closed at this time. So not real sure where that stands right now. However, DATCAP has a list of other soil labs around the state that are currently accepting samples. So either one of those may be an option at this point.
Sure. And in terms of mistakes, what are some common mistakes the new gardeners make?
Well, one of the things that happens, particularly in the spring, is that people put out plants too early, particularly things like tomatoes, peppers, basil. All of those are crops that really are warm weather crops, and people tend to try and push the envelope to get the plants going soon as they can, and often that's actually too soon. And we did have, people lose things already that they've put out, and then we had that nasty freeze event.
Yeah, that's I learned my lesson a long time ago on pepper plants. Mm-hmm. You do not want to get them out too early because you will not wind up with any peppers.
Yeah, they really tend to, and tomatoes as well, yeah. They tend to, even if they don't show any damage on the leaves, they can end up just being stunted. They really just don't want to grow in those kinds of conditions, and it can actually set them back.
Well, Deborah in Madison has a question about something you've probably been questioned about before. Let's go there. Hi, Deborah. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I'm wondering, is there anything new for controlling Asian jumping worms? other than, trying to cover the entire yard with Dawn and mustard powder, I read the tea tree seed oil, tea tree seed meal mixed in that has been used in England and Europe for a long time. You sort of spread, broadcast it, water it in, and then you rake them up.
Yes, there used to be a product called Early Bird, which is an organic fertilizer that was produced primarily as an organic fertilizer, but it does have the property of that tea seed meal, which irritates the membranes of the jumping worms and would bring them to the surface where they would dry out and die. And unfortunately, due to the tariffs, that product is not being produced anymore. I had heard before the COVID-19 pandemic that there were possibilities that it might be coming back, but I assume all of that is on hold now. So that was the only tool that I had to recommend. In the state of Wisconsin, it did have a dispensation for being used for this off-label use of as a vermicide, but it was not labeled actually as a vermicide. But again, Wisconsin did allow the use of that, but it's not available anymore. So if you were able to get tea seed meal in some fashion, it could possibly be used, but I can't technically recommend that because it's not labeled for that use.
Yeah, yeah. So, Deborah, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Martha in Middleton emailed a photo showing a problem with her zinnia seedlings. She thinks it may be powdery mildew. Is
yeah,
it?
I'm looking at that. It
doesn't look like
me,
powder. It doesn't look like powdery mildew to me.
No, it looks like scorch to me.
Yeah.
Either that, or if the plants had been out during the freeze, it could be frost damage as well. But it does look. I'm wondering if she was hardening them off outside and they got a little bit too much sun. That's kind of what it looks like to me.
Yeah, that's kind of what it looks like to me too. I don't see any powdery mildew there at all.
Yeah, and it would be really early in the season for that kind of thing as well.
So probably scorch, or on the other hand, if it was left out on one of those cold nights, you get a little problem there.
Yeah, even if it was covered on one of those nights, that could have happened.
So let's go to Annie in Dalton next. Hi, Annie. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have this cheap little weed whacker that is a rechargeable battery, but it runs for about 15, 20 minutes, and then you have to recharge it for 2 hours.
Oh.
I was wondering, with a two-acre yard, and then someone else wants me to do their yard also, can you recommend a good brand or a good type of weed whacker? The one place I won't be able to plug in. Most of the places, actually, I won't be able to reach with a cord. So something gas or rechargeable.
Yeah, you probably would need to go with a gas-powered unit of some kind. I'm assuming that mowing isn't an option for these areas. Is this like around trees or something? Or
Yes, okay. And under some little stone benches and things like that.
Okay, yeah. If it is around trees, you do need to be very careful with string trimmers or any kind of weed whackers that you don't damage the bark, just to put that in there, because that can really harm the tree, so you want to make sure about that. I don't actually have any particular brands to recommend. I know there are a lot of different ones out there, and they're being, you know, introduced all the time.
Yeah, I've got one that you plug in, and I've had it so long I don't even remember the name of the weed whacker. But you're probably going to have a gasoline one and just have to look, I guess, at recommendations and see what's out there, Annie. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@WPR.org with your gardening questions or maybe an experience to share in the garden. Mary in Rubicon up next. Hi, Mary.
Well, hello. Good to speak with you.
Yeah.
Hey, I started. I am a first-time straw bale gardener. I've got it all conditioned. I heard your guests say don't put out your tomato plants and peppers too early. I do have covers over it at night. Is that enough to protect it?
It depends on how low the temperature goes. Technically, tomatoes should not be out if the temperature is any lower than 50. And actually, during the growing season, they can abort flowers and fruits if the temperature goes below 55 at night. So if you have it close to your, you know, house, that'll certainly help. But the problem is, again, that even if you have it covered, if it goes down to, you know, 45, 40, that can still end up stunting the plant.
The bales, yeah, I, you know, with any straw bales that I've used, I frankly, I don't put the tomatoes in until no earlier than like Memorial weekend,
right.
last of May, and I'm in, here we are in southern Wisconsin, so, but if they're out already, Mary, you're just going to have to take a look, watch to see if you get any aborting on the flowers. Do you have flowers yet on them?
I would imagine not.
I don't.
Small.
Yeah, they're really.
It's just that physiologically it's hard for, you know, the tomato is a tropical plant, and so it really just tends to slow down and be stunted, not really grow very much if it experiences a lot of those kinds of temperatures, even if it doesn't die or show any particular symptoms. Certainly, you know, covering it and so on will help, but I don't know that will prevent damage.
So you're going to have to keep an eye on it, Mary.
Yeah.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Lisa Johnson, our guest today, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. All of us for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. Join in, 800-642-1234, email at ideas@WPR.org. Let's take a call from Dave in Broadhead. Dave, hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. Hey, I've got a question. We've got an asparagus bed that's probably 6-7 years old, and the asparagus comes up, and some of them are like bigger than my thumb, and some of them are the size of a pencil. And I'm just wondering if there's something that needs to be done if some of these plants are, like, getting not enough nutrients or there's something wrong with the soil kind of thing. But I have a couple that aren't coming up, and I think that might be because the bed's older. I don't know. I'm just kind of curious.
Yeah. What do you think, Lisa?
Yeah, let me ask you a couple of questions. You said the beds are 6 to 7, or the plants are 6 to 7 years old. Did you buy all of the same variety?
Yes, we did. Yep,
okay.
They're all the same variety, and we bought 2-year-old roots.
Okay. And do you know what those varieties were by chance?
No.
Whether they were male varieties?
That I can't tell you either. In fact, until I listened to a different show, I didn't even know that there was a difference.
Sure. Yeah. The male plants that don't produce the fruits tend to be a lot more uniform in their production, and they tend to be a lot more, I don't want to say fruitful because they're not producing fruits, but they tend to produce a lot more spears, and bigger spears, be more vigorous, et cetera, because they're not, you know, producing the flowers and fruit that the females would. If you bought one of the older type varieties, they do tend to be a little bit less uniform, where you would get more variation in spear size. That being said, because these are younger plants, you may still be experiencing them producing newer spears that are from buds that are newer, which would explain why you're getting a variety of different sizes in the spears as they come up. I suspect once your plants get to be more like, you know, 8 to 10 years old, that you'll see a better sort of uniformity. However, that being said, there is the possibility of soil issues, especially if you're seeing some of them come up and some of them not coming up in terms of a whole plant. So you might want to get a soils test done and just kind of see what you're dealing with. The other possibility is that I would assume that you planted them all at the same depth and they were all planted at the same time.
They were planted all. I just made a big long trench and planted them all at the same time.
Okay, yeah. Awesome. Yeah, and are the ones that are not coming up now, are they ones that had come up before?
Yes, yep, they had all come up before. And I thought possibly, too, since it's been such a weird spring, that maybe some of them are going to come up. They just haven't popped through yet.
Yeah, and that is entirely possible. Did you notice any difference after last year's polar vortex, not this past winter, but the winter before? Because sometimes with perennial plants, if you have damage, you don't always see the full extent of it the first year. I mean, some years, you know, you'll lose the whole thing, and that's pretty obvious, but sometimes you might have noticed that one of them was a little bit less vigorous, and then, you know, you might lose it entirely this year. So I just wondered if you'd noticed any of that.
I really haven't noticed too much, but that's something I'll have to look at. Yeah, some of the I know some of them weren't quite as vigorous last year.
I mean, asparagus, they're usually, you know, pretty tough, but also one thing that they're very sensitive to is poor drainage. So if you have any areas of the garden that or of your trench, I should say, that are lower and don't seem to drain as well, you could have some root rot going on.
Yeah, that's another potential issue.
Yeah.
Dave, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's give Jean a chance in Platteville to join in. Hi, Jean.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my phone call. I have just to help two things. One thing, just to kind of help that one lady that was having problems with her weed whacker that she was, you know, having the cord. For one thing, I have a weed whacker, but it's a great, it is a good size battery on it. So you can get now, you can get the batteries larger, so it stores a lot, and boy, you can go on for a good hour or more with it. So the size of the battery has increased, and they've done a really good. And then cords are kind of the thing of the past. You don't want to use a cord because that's really cumbersome. So that's just my helping that lady out. And then my second one was about a bulge on a cherry tree. Okay, so this bulge is smaller, and then it gets bigger, and then it gets bigger, and then it gets bigger. I don't know. I had one tree that was just so huge. It was, you know, really large and tall, and it was great cherries. And then 5 years, it was just dead. It just broke my heart. So I have these other cherry trees now, but they still get that darn bulge, you know, right there.
Where does it occur? On the trunk?
Yeah, more on the trunk, up though, up, you know, like a couple feet up. You know.
Like a burl? Do you know
what a burl looks like?
Is it kind of like cracked and large, or?
It grows larger. And then the poor tree, you know, it just, I don't know what to do. I want to hold it and hug it.
Oh. Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Well, yeah, there are certainly some types of fungal infections, cankers, and so on that can produce those kinds of things. I think I'd really like to look at it or have Brian Huddleston from the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic take a good quality digital picture and email that to him. He could probably advise you as to exactly what that is.
It's Gene, it's the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, so it's PDDC, Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, UW-Madison. And if you can send a photo there, Brian almost for sure is going to be able to, get a good photo, he's going to be able to help you out.
All right. Is there a phone number, too, is with that?
Yes, 608-262-2867.
6-3. All right. 6-3. Thank you for your help. I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
I'm sorry that I had two items instead of just one.
That's all right, Gene. Thank you so much. David in Green Bay will turn to you next. Hi, David.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Larry.
Sure.
I just had a question about a fruit tree. I had bought a Japanese plum tree, Japanese spruce plum, and planted it in the backyard. On the tag, it says I need to have a companion plant for cross-pollination in order for it to fruit well. It recommended a methylene plum, but I don't have a huge yard, and I don't really need two plum trees. Is there other cultivars, Japanese cultivars, that I could use to get that cross-pollination accomplished?
I am checking that out. I believe, though, that with those that you do need to have... I'm sorry, you said it was a Japanese plum?
Yeah, Japanese spruce, it's called. It's a hybrid.
Wow, that's one I have not heard of before. I am not sure. A lot of the plums do need a pollinator, or they're just like apples that are self-incompatible with the pollen, that they can't pollinate their own flowers, and they do need a second tree. Sometimes you can get fruit trees that have two varieties grafted on them to try and help with that kind of problem. And with apple trees, if you have a crab apple nearby, that can help pollinate it. But plums are a little bit different. We do have a publication called, I think it's Growing Peaches, Cherries, and Plums in Wisconsin at the Learning Store. And I know it does have a section on recommended varieties. We also have a newer publication on growing. Are you in the northern or the southern part of the state?
I'm kind of central, outside of Oshkosh.
Okay. So we have a newer publication on growing varieties that should be selected for the southern part of the state. I don't think the northern one has been updated yet. So here it is, growing apricots, cherries, peaches, and plums in Wisconsin. And that one is, if you just go to, if you just Google Learning Store UW or Learning Store Extension, that should bring that up. And the number of the publication is A3639. That's A3639. 1639, and if you type that into the search box, it should bring it up. You don't have to buy the publication. You can actually just view it online, and it gives information about planting and pruning and different kinds of varieties.
I was doing a little bit of looking around as you were talking. It does have a self-fertile quality to it, meaning its own flower number should be enough to result in adequate pollination by honeybees. But for best results, you do need two trees.
Yeah. Yeah, so you might be able to get a lighter crop. It's really going to depend on the particular variety that you have.
And the two trees, they were saying, at least this source that I have says they need to be about within 100 feet of each other for the best.
Right, yeah, the closer the better, obviously, but yeah.
All right. Best we can do today, David. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's take another call. Rita Lynn in Green Bay. It's your turn. Hi, Rita Lynn. We have Rita Lynn there? No, perhaps we lost her. Well, you can join in. We have some open lines for you at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Vicki in Mount Horeb emailed. She has an east-facing hillside that would she would like to have to quit mowing. Still wants it green but low maintenance. Are there some good ground covers you would recommend that are native or at least non-invasive exotics that would work? The soil isn't great. Clay and sand with some rock, of course. Part of it's sun and part of it's shaded. Also, she wants to know how to get good ground cover started. Not Creeping Charlie.
No. Before I answer that, I just want to go back to the Japanese plum question. I just checked in the... in that publication, it is saying that Japanese plums usually die if temperatures fall to 0 degrees. So the whole thing about pollination may be a moot point.
A moot point, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it says that's the fruit buds. The leaf buds may be just fine, but the flower buds will probably be damaged, especially if you're up north. So the question about ground covers in partial shade that are native, one of the best ones is actually Canadian ginger. And that one, it's a real good spreader. Forms a nice mat, and it's, you know, fairly quick. It's really good at holding soil together. So I guess that would be my top recommendation for a native ground cover. I'm sorry, did she say what part of the state she was from?
Mount Horeb.
Mount Horeb, okay. I was going to, there's also European wild ginger. But that one is hardy to zone 5, and I know sometimes Mount Horeb, because of the, you know, topography, can end up being a little bit more like a zone 4B.
No.
So I'm not so sure that one would do well. You know, there are a lot of hostas, too, that are rhizomatous that will create a nice ground cover. One of my favorites is lemon lime, which is a little shorter yellow type one, yellow chartreusey color. There's another one that's called lemon, let's see, no, that one, okay, so lemon lime and yellow polka dot bikini. That one's a fun too. fun one, too, that is pretty good at forming a ground cover.
I was going to share her other part of the question was, how do you get ground cover started in existing grass?
Oh, in existing grass. She says
dig it all up, or?
Yeah, I would kill off the grass first, if at all possible. It's not too big an area, if you can cover it with a black plastic or a tarp for the season, that should do it. And then you can plant into that the next year. It's a lot easier if you can wait a season for it to start to decay. Another thing that can work really well as a ground cover partial shade is bloodroot. That's another really nice native plant. Mine has been seeding all over the place. I'm looking out my back window right now, and I've had the house since 2005, and I probably put them in around 2006, so I'm actually getting to the point where I might have to thin them out a little bit.
Well,
and another one is there is a Stoloniferous phlox. Creeping phlox is one of the names for it, but it's not the creeping phlox that has the needle-like leaves. But it's a Stoloniferous type that also does really well in partial shade.
Let's take another call here. AJ in Shawano, your turn now. Hi, AJ.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just beginning a raised garden. I've got the garden built. It's 14 inches. The wall is 14 inches high. I'm just wondering how much soil I should put in, you know, as a beginning garden bed. And I also have a question about compost. Should I mix that compost directly then with that new soil, or should I just do like the first top dressing of 6 inches, 3 inches? Not sure how to go about it now. Everything's waiting for me.
Okay,
I'm not sure how to proceed.
The bed is completely empty right now?
Yeah, it's completely empty. Yeah.
Okay. I don't recommend using like completely topsoil or composted manure or something like that, because in a raised bed situation, it tends to just get compacted and turn into a brick. So what I like to do is take about either 50% bagged soil or bagged potting mix, which is a much lighter, it's actually usually a soilless mix. So sometimes it's called potting mix, sometimes it's called potting soil, even though it doesn't really have soil in it. And then mix that either like one-third composted manure or one-third topsoil, all the way up to 50% topsoil and or manure with that. And make sure if you do use manure that it is composted manure. But if you just use straight compost or straight topsoil, that just tends to be too heavy in a raised bed.
So you get a little mixing.
Hello? I have the compost already. It's manure compost.
Okay.
You would recommend me mixing that with the topsoil with that potting mix then. Is that correct? Everything together?
Yes. So you would have 50% of the potting mix and 50% of your manure slash compost slash topsoil. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I'll give it a try. Thank you.
And then when you fill your bed, you want to make sure that you have a little bit of a water reservoir. So if the top can be around a couple of inches below where the top of the bed is, that will help, just to make sure that it doesn't all, you know, splash out or run over.
Yeah, there we go. Good luck, AJ. Sounds like you're going to have a nice garden there. Thank you. Craig in Hudson, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I've heard you talk so much over the years about your limey that I couldn't resist. And about 4 weeks ago, I ordered one, and it just came yesterday. And it's a 3-foot bare lime tree. And I'm wondering how I can best get it started in condition now that we have at home and potting it. They recommended putting cedar mulch in it along with some soil mix and whatever, but I just wondered how best I should get it started.
Well, you have a, what's your pot size?
The pot size, it'll probably be, I'm guessing it came in, of course, an existing one, but it will probably move it into something that's probably going to be, I would guess, 12 to 14 inches in diameter.
Yeah, that should work pretty well. And really, there's not a whole lot that you need to do. It sounds like you've got the right mixture there for your, in terms of the pot size and in terms of what you've got to plant your limey into. So I'd say go ahead and do that. And then they do like a lot of fertilizer. They do like, they're heavy feeders, let's put it that way. What I do is every time I water it, I put in some small amount of liquid fertilizer, and I just use that every time I water the plant, which is usually about once a week. They don't like wet feet too much either, so you need to be a little careful of that.
Yeah, they do like good drainage.
Yeah, they like good drainage for sure. And I use the liquid I use is a fish emulsion fertilizer. There are some fertilizers out there that are specifically for citrus, but frankly, I've had really good luck mixing in a bit of that fish emulsion fertilizer, and then I just do it every time I water, and then you should be in great shape. Make sure you turn. You know, it's going to be sitting outside for now, so make sure that you, if there's a sun angle, make sure that you move it, turn it around a little bit so that it doesn't start bending over too much in one direction, which Limey started to do, and I had to make some adjustments. and then in the fall. When it starts getting, you know, cool, bring it in a sunny location. I used a grow light with it. And again, you need to be turning it as as the weeks go by. Does that help, Craig?
Leave it outside most of the time now that it's getting warm out, or should I bring it inside and kind of condition it a little bit?
Yeah, it's you're still getting, we're still getting some pretty cool nights. So it's probably better if you condition it.
Yeah, I would make sure that if it's under 55 degrees, that it's not outside.
Yeah, yep. So I have limey on a second floor patio right now, and so it works pretty good from that height, and it's on a south-facing patio, so works pretty well. There you go, Craig. Good luck.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, appreciate your call. Diane in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Diane.
Well, thanks for taking my call. I have a neighbor that has a lot of naked ladies in her yard, which is a lily plant. And, you know, they come up with their leaves early in the spring, and then the leaves disappear, and then all of a sudden, a beautiful lady appears. So I'm wondering, how deep do we need to dig down to transplant? When is the best time to transplant that type of a bulb?
Yeah, you know, those are also called resurrection lilies, just to throw that out there. They are rather beautiful things. And I have seen some really, really nice plantings of those. I have not ever grown them myself. And I know that, you know, some of them are more hardy than others. What area are you in? I'm sorry, did you say?
We're in South La Crosse. And
oh, okay.
These are hardy because nothing is being done with them. And actually, you know, I told the people that moved into the house to not mow down the leaves because that is the fuel for the bulb to send up the flowers.
Yeah.
And nothing is being done. No fertilization, you know. And so I more or less can go and dig these little guys up. Our little gals up and and transplant them, and I don't know, you know, when would be the best time, how deep they are. I know they're a deep bulb. They're down deep.
About 6 inches is pretty good. I would treat them like, you know, like most other spring flowering bulbs, and I would plant them in the fall, or dig them up in the fall to transplant them.
Yeah. There you go, Diane. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your garden today on the Ideas Network for this edition of Garden Talk, I'm Larry Mueller with my guest Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. Give a call. Number's 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Let's take another call. Lou in Ashland County. Your turn. Hi, Lou.
Hi there. I'm just wondering, the gal who wanted ground cover, why is no one mentioning sedge? I'm just curious. I'm going to be doing that, changing out my grass for sedge and adding wildflowers and trying to get as back to what's native here, something that'll give back to, you know, the insects and the birds. But just curious if you could talk a little bit about sedge, please.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure. There are a number. We have native sedges that will do quite nicely. There are tons of, you know, ground covers that you can use. One of my favorite sedges is, I think it's called Blue Rabbit. I'm trying to remember. We have it in the teaching garden at the Dane County Extension building, and it's kind of a blue green color, and it's about 8 inches tall. We also have some other sedges. There are some that are semi-evergreen. Ice Dance is one of those. It's a nice variegated sedge. I also have a sedge in my personal garden that is called Banana Boat, that is bright yellow. That one I've noticed, though, if you have any sun on it at all, it tends to burn a little bit. But Pennsylvania sedge, for example, is a native, and there are many different kinds of sedges that you can use. They're going to have more of a obviously grass-like texture than some of the other plants that I was mentioning that are all broadleaves.
Heather in Brookfield has a question or a comment. Hi, Heather. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. So I was calling because I'm in the process of converting a flower garden into a vegetable garden, and I want to make this a victory garden in memory of my grandmother. I'm curious to know. Yeah, isn't that fun? So I'm curious to know, like, historically, what vegetables might be appropriate for a victory garden, or is it just what we like, or that kind of thing?
I think, you know, at the time that the victory gardens were being grown, the idea was to help support the troops by growing things that, you know, could be grown for sending to wherever, but also to be able to produce your own food to help make sure that, you know, your family was taken care of and that the food supply that was being agriculturally, commercially produced could, you know, go to the war effort. So depending on where you are, you know, in the country, of course, you would grow whatever sorts of things would work in your area and what you wanted to use for your family. I know that a number of things would have been grown that could be canned and, you know, saved over winter. So everything from beans to tomatoes and certainly a lot of the root crops that could be held in root cellars over winter, I'm sure were used as well. I don't think there was any particular sort of thing that was grown that I particularly with.
I think you're exactly right. The garden would vary depending on what part of the country a person was in, and you grew what you liked and what would store well. Or could be canned. So those are all things to consider. And Heather, in the end, you can pretty much, you know, what works well in the Brookfield area is probably, you can call it a victory garden. I'd throw some hollyhocks in.
As long as you don't have Japanese beetles.
Yeah, as long as you don't have
Japanese. Because then you end up feeding the beetles. But yeah, I'm sure your grandmother would be more than proud with anything that that you would put in for feeding your family.
Yeah, now we have victory gardens for the war against COVID-19. I see that out there as well. So it's you could have a double victory garden there, Heather. Thank you very much for calling. Oh, Judy in Deerfield, your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about raspberry bushes.
Okay.
I started this bed about 9 years ago, and I mulch it heavily every year. But the leaves have started turning yellowish, and I've researched online. It looks like it needs iron. But there's all these different opinions on how to treat it with blood meal or iron sulfide manure. What would you say is the best thing to do?
Well, I would say actually the first thing to do is to take a soil test because it may very well not be iron. There are a number of things that can cause yellow leaves. It could be lack of nitrogen. It could actually be if you have a very heavy coat of mulch. Raspberries are quite sensitive to drainage issues, and if you have too much mulch on and the soil stays too wet, you could actually be developing root rot, and one of the symptoms of that is yellowing leaves. So I would not mulch any deeper than a couple of inches to be sure that you're not causing drainage problems. Now, on the other hand, if you have sandy soil, 3-inch mulch is probably fine.
All right.
But I would check your do a soil test first to see what might be going on there.
Thank you very much for calling. Jan in Madison, your turn. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I have a very narrow strip in front of evergreen bushes. I get afternoon sun. There's a lot of squirrels and baby rabbits out there. And I'd like to be able to plant some low herbs. There's some weeds I got to get rid of. They're very low level. And how to augment soil. And if not herbs, are there any flowers I can plant?
All right.
So you're looking for something to put in front of your evergreen bushes in an area that it sounds like it gets a lot of sun and maybe dry, and you're looking for herbs that you can eat, or
and not feed the animals. Is there anything I can put around it that the animals don't like?
Oh, okay. Yes. Okay. So some herbs that you could try there. Some of the thymes might do really well. I would plant some of the little bit taller thymes, like silver thyme, for example, or English thyme. Those usually get about, 6 inches tall. And typically, animals are not going to want to eat something like that. If you could also try chives. Those will definitely spread.
Yeah, no problem there. Lisa Johnson, our guest today. Lisa, UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. To have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest Lisa Johnson, UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County and a leader in the Master Gardeners Training Program. So, what gardening questions are on your mind? Give a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And callers online, so let's take a call here. Sharon in Butler, you are next. Thank you for calling in.
Oh, hi, Larry and Lisa. This is wonderful. I've got a trellis I'd like to get something to grow on, and I would like an evergreen climber that's non-invasive. I know you might recommend ivy, but I know that kind of takes over.
Where are you located?
Butler.
Okay, that's
it faces north.
Okay, and I'm sorry, what county is that in?
Waukesha.
Oh, it's in Waukesha. Okay, thank you. Okay, so there really aren't a whole lot of evergreen climbers. Almost everything I can think of is going to be deciduous. Even the ivies, there aren't very many that are hardy in our area that would climb up a trellis. Most of them would be on the ground. Now, there you could try euonymus. They do tend to be fairly susceptible, though, to winter burn, which is also the problem with the ivy. Was there a particular reason that you needed evergreen, or?
I found as I'm getting older, they're less care, and they give you pleasure all year round.
Sure. Yeah. Because even like I wouldn't recommend it anymore because it's kind of invasive. But even purple leaf winter creeper, they just because of the evergreen nature, they do tend to, dry out if they're not actually on the ground. I guess I would probably, did you say it was in sun or in shade?
Unfortunately, faces north, so it might get early morning when the sun's arcing.
Well, you,
I'm not thinking.
Yeah, I mean, there is like climbing hydrangea vine, but those usually don't do well on a trellis. They're more needing like tree bark or a house to sink their their roots into or their hold fast. Let's see. And clematis, that's not going to be enough sun for that.
We're getting stumped here.
Yeah. The other, there's Japanese hydrangea vine, but that also, it's related to the climbing hydrangea vine. That's about the only other thing I can think of for shade right now. There's probably something else. You know, years ago, I would have recommended porcelain vine, but that's now on the invasives list, so I can't recommend that anymore. And I can't recommend Akebia anymore for the same reason. Yeah, I'm getting, nothing is coming to mind at the moment.
Maybe somebody else listening in has got a suggestion.
Yeah.
Sharon, you're going to have to stay listening, and we'll see if we can get some help from some other people.
About that. You know, there might be some even annual vines that would work, but, you know, you'd have to replant them every year.
Yeah. Maybe we'll get some advice from somebody else. Sharon, stay listening.
There's honeysuckle vines, but they also are going to need some more sun.
Stay listening, Sharon. Thanks for calling. Rita Lynn in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Rita Lynn.
Hello?
Hi, Rita. Lynn, what's on your mind today?
Well, thanks for taking my call. I have in my lawn, by the edges, I think where it was overseeded, a grass that really doesn't root in the soil. It roots primarily in the dead grass. And when you rake it, it just comes up in rolls.
Oh, okay.
I'm wondering what to do with my lawn because there are several, not quite a few spots, areas on edges where that with grass was apparently was planted because it only gets about an inch and a half or an inch.
Yeah, it's probably creeping bent grass, which is not a desirable grass to have. I would try and kill that off. You could either, you know, try smothering it or spraying it if you didn't mind doing that, and then put a different variety of grass in that area. That I've had actually a lot of calls about that this year. For some reason, it seems to be having a really good year.
So you need to get rid of it, and
right? For this killing?
Oh, for replanting, for killing it? You could do that now, couldn't she?
Absolutely. Yeah, and then just seed in a more desirable grass. We actually at the Learning Store have a really nice publication that can help guide you on different varieties of grass that will do well in different areas. And it is called, I believe, Establishing and Renovating Lawns.
Sounds about right.
I can take a look at that one while we're answering another question and get back to you on what the exact title of that one is at the Learning Store.
Okay, we will do that. Rita, stay listening, and we will turn to another caller.
I already got it. Lawn Establishment and Renovation. And let's see if I can get the publication number is A3434. And if you type that into the search box at the Learning Store, that'll bring that up. And again, you don't have to buy it. You can view it and print it online.
Yep. So just go to UW Learning Store and you will find it. Rita, thank you for calling. Let's go to Dot in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Dot.
Hi. I have a question for you. I have a crabapple tree, and I trimmed it a few weeks ago, but I get a lot of apples on the ground, and you guys had told me one time to treat it with some type of insecticide, but I'm not sure what that insecticide was and when to treat it.
Was the recommendation in order to get the fruits to be thinned? Was that it for chemical thinning?
No, I get so many crab apples on the ground. And at one time, your program told me to make sure to trim it in the early spring or late winter and then treat it with some kind of insecticide, but I don't know what kind of insecticide to use and when to treat it with the insecticide.
Okay. I'm wondering if it was this maybe a while ago that the recommendation was made?
I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, usually what we would recommend is, you know, if you knew what the insect was, that you treat specifically for that insect. The reason that it could be dropping fruits are a lot of different things. It may not necessarily be insect damage. It could be that the fruits are not getting pollinated properly, and so the tree drops them. It could be due to frost happening at an inopportune time, causing them to drop. It could certainly be insect damage, but I don't like to recommend, you know, a chemical unless I know what I'm recommending it for. There are certainly, if you wanted to look at some of the fruit publications, there are general broad spectrum things that you can use, but those can be damaging to bees. So we certainly don't want things to be sprayed during flowering because that will hurt the bees and other pollinators. So what you might want to do is contact PJ Leash at our insect diagnostic lab and see if he could help you ferret out what exactly, if it is an insect problem, what's causing that issue. And then he could better recommend a chemical that would be better targeted that wouldn't be an environmental issue.
Yeah, so the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, that would be the place to go, Dot. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Jerry in Green Lake, we're on to you now. Hi, Jerry.
Ben, hi. How are you today?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Okay, I grow a lot of vegetables. I have a garden about 40 by 60, and I put in a lot of green beans, and a lot of them are just bush beans, and I also use some tripods and put in pole beans. In the last couple years, the pole beans grow like crazy. There's all the greens, they're so beautiful, you should take a picture of them. But there's not a single blossom and not a single bean.
Wow.
I'm wondering if you have any thoughts. I don't want to stump you. It's, you know.
No.
That's were they the same variety or different varieties?
A couple of times, you know, Blue Lake and others, but
okay.
It doesn't seem to make a difference.
I do remember a few years ago there was some kind of issue with Blue Lake, which is why I asked, where I seem to remember the problem at that time was that the bush beans ended up being more like pole beans, but I seem to recall there was some issue as well with them not bearing well, and I can't quite remember what the issue was with that. I take it you're not having that same kind of issue with any of the other beans?
Beans grow, you know, like they're supposed to, but just nothing on the pole beans. I move them around a little bit in the garden from year to year. And
okay, so you're not necessarily even growing them in the same place, and you're fertilizing them the same as your other plants?
Right.
Huh.
That's a stumper.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes if the soil is too rich with nitrogen, you can have things not producing.
But if everything else is growing,
Yeah, it doesn't
all around
it
doesn't them
make sense. And if you've moved it so that we know that it's not related to a particular area of, you know, of the soil. Huh. I am not sure what would be causing that.
Jerry, you got us stumped.
Yeah.
I don't know either.
Beans are usually quite reliable.
Yeah.
You're going to have to. Maybe somebody else will come up with that.
I have no ideas. Jerry, I'm sorry. Keep trying. Hope for the best. Thank you. Marty in Palmyra, your turn. Hi, Marty.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I have a birch tree, a white birch tree, 30, 40 feet tall. And last year, the leaves were skeletonized. And prior to that, there are these caterpillars that are probably the diameter of a pencil, black, brownish in color, fuzzy, furry, that I believe are contributing to this. And I thought I got a whiff of some sort of a spike that I'm supposed to put in the ground at the beginning of the year when they start sucking nutrients out of the ground. Can you enlighten me a bit on that?
Okay. I missed what type of tree you said it was.
White birch. A white birch.
Oh, being skeletonized?
The leaves,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, certainly Japanese beetles will do that. Does this happen? I'm sorry, what area are you in again?
Palmyra.
Palmyra. Okay. Usually,
and these are caterpillars.
So, yeah. Oh, you're seeing caterpillars.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they're black?
There are certainly some native butterflies that can do some of, you know, that can be out there. Gypsy moth also is fuzzy, so that's a possibility. What time of year are you seeing these?
Oh, we lost him, unfortunately.
Oh, shoot.
He said they were a blackish color, gypsy moths.
And, you know, depending on the time of year, when gypsy moth is young, it can do that. Now, birch is not their favorite tree, though. Usually when I hear about birch being skeletonized, the first thing I think of are either Japanese beetles or possibly birch leaf miner are the two things that I would think about. If the listener is still there, if you can take some photos of them, that would help. I'm not aware, though, of, you could certainly use some kind of systemic. I'm expecting that's what he's talking about with a spike. I'm not aware, though, of any systemics that are in that form. The only thing I'm aware of with that would be fertilizer spikes.
You might want to send a photo to the insect diagnostic lab.
If you can get a photo to PJ. I mean, I'd certainly hate to have you kill off something that's actually a butterfly caterpillars.
Yeah. If you've got a photo, send it to PJ Leash at the UW. Well, just go to the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. You might also just go online and take a look at his site. He's got a lot of photos, and you might be able to find a photo that matches what the caterpillar that you're looking at. Another tough one. Well, you had a few tough ones here right in a row. Well, here's one we can answer. Kate emailed to ask how she can best add mulch to her iris beds.
Oh, okay. I'm assuming that these are German bearded iris?
Probably.
Yeah. Okay, so one thing you want to make sure to do is you don't want to over-mulch iris. They need to have part of that rhizome above ground. So I usually minimize the amount that are around my iris. I would only put about an inch to an inch and a half worth of shredded bark mulch, and I would not have it directly up against the leaves or the rhizomes. So you need to be really careful with those.
And Carol emailed to ask, well, she here's another asparagus bed issue, 8 years old and producing less every year. She fertilizes every year with compost.
Okay.
What's the best way to fertilize? What should she do?
I'm kind of wondering, I mean, 8 years old is quite young for a asparagus patch to not be producing. I'm kind of wondering if maybe something else is going on there, whether it is poor drainage or, I mean, it certainly could be a nutrient issue. But I tend to think that if the spears are the ones that are being produced are looking healthy, good color, and so on, that it might be more of a drainage issue or something like that. I would get a soil test done, and if you don't see anything problematic there and you're still having issues, then I would try and get a sample into the plant disease diagnostic clinic just to see if you've got root rot or something like that going on. If all else seems fine and the soils lab confirms that maybe you're missing some nitrogen, you can use either a slow-release product or you could, and usually, you know, you're going to want to do that earlier in the season, or you could potentially use something a little bit, you know, later on, a water-soluble type of product. We do, I think, in our commercial at the Learning Store, there is a commercial vegetable growing publication, and there is a section on asparagus that gives specific recommendations for fertilizers, but I'm not convinced that it's a fertilizer issue since it's so young.
Yeah, for sure. Lisa, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for asking me. It was great to be back. Sorry not to see you in person at the studio, but it's great.
We'll get
to hear
together
your
voice. At some point. Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you.
Johnson, UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County, our guest. You know, we talked about the Learning Store and some and Master Gardener websites. We have those available. Go to WPR.org/Larry, and the websites and so forth are listed under our program notes. So you can find those under our program notes. Well, great to have her with us. Coming up Monday, Jill and Lori will be back to take your physical therapy questions. So I hope you can join us for that on the Ideas Network. And check out our blog. We have some new entries today, two of them, one on gut health and another on native plants that attract bees to your garden. Just go to WPR.org/Larry to see what's there. And thanks for listening to Garden Talk. Stay with us. Lots more in store. Again, I'm Larry Mueller.